Well, it's good to see everybody on this Labor Day weekend. And just real quick, for those of you in the room, I want to say something to our friends online. Okay, yeah, there we go. Hey, thanks for inviting us. Oh, you didn't get it. Yeah, for those of you who are at the beach and at the lake and at wherever you are, yeah, thanks for inviting us. We're fine, aren't we fine? No, we're fine, yeah. But we'd rather be here, wouldn't we? Absolutely. Okay, there you go. Hey, we're in part four of this series that I absolutely love, Starting Point. And the premise of this series, if you haven't been here, is simply that faith has a starting point. We know that everything else has a starting point, but sometimes we don't think about the fact that our faith had a starting point. Once upon a time, you weren't sure what to believe, or you didn't believe anything, and then somebody came along and said, here, believe this. And it was probably your mama or your daddy, and then they took you to synagogue or a temple or to the church, or took you somewhere, and next thing you knew, you were, you know, being spoon-fed all this stuff, and you were a kid, and it was like, well, of course I believe. You know, I believe in Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, and Jesus, and, you know, whatever else they told you to believe because we're kids, and it all worked, didn't it? And you were taught God is good and God is great and, you know, all those things. And then we hit high school, and then we started wandering a little bit in terms of lifestyle, and then we hit college, and we didn't even think about all that stuff. And then we became adults, and we settled kind of back into responsible living. At least most of us have. Some of you are still figuring that out, and that's okay. We're happy that you're here or watching online, wherever you are. And then, but at some point along the way, for many of us, not all of us, but I would guess many of us, and I would be included in the many, there was this growing gap between what we've been taught as children and what we experienced as adults. And we responded to this gap in one of two ways. Some of us just said, I'm just going to believe it anyway, you know? And so people would say, hey, don't Christians believe, or don't Jews believe, or don't Muslims believe, or don't whatever you are believe. And yet here's this reality, and we're like, well, you just have to believe, or I don't know, or I don't want to look over there. I don't want to face that. Don't show me that, because it just undermines my faith. But I want to hang on to my faith. Some of you responded like that. Others of us, you know, looked at reality and went, wow, there's a problem. Here's what I was taught. Here's, you know, current reality, and there is a gap, and I don't know if I can keep believing. And for the most part, nobody, I don't think many people just decide, I'm not believing that anymore. I'm just walking away from my childhood faith. It just sort of gets chiseled away. It just becomes a little bit irrelevant. Next thing you know, you're married, or you're about to get married, or you're finishing up college, or you're having kids, and you just get busy. And it's not like you sit down and spend a lot of time thinking this through, but there's just such a disparity between the, you know, childhood Bible stories or stories from whatever book you grew up being taught, and reality. And then somebody says, hey, well, you need to come back to temple with me, or hey, you need to come to church with me. And, you know, it kind of pulls on your heartstrings a little bit, but there's just too much of a gap. So what do you do with that? So what we decided to do in this series is ask the question, what would it look like to start over? What would it look like to have an adult starting point? What would it look like to just sort of wipe the slate clean? And we can't completely do that because we have roots and emotional ties to all kinds of religious beliefs and belief systems, and that's fine. But for the most part, what if we could begin asking some of those fundamental questions over again, and we actually ask for adult answers to some of those questions? So that's what this whole series is about. It's about an adult starting point. Now, we're in part four. So if you missed the first three, you can actually go to startingpointseries.com, and all these messages are up there. They'll be there as long as there's an internet, and today's message will be up there. And if you have friends and you're thinking, oh, I wish my brother had seen this, or I've been trying to explain that to my sister-in-law, and you said it in a way that I haven't been able to say it, or she won't listen to me, maybe she'll listen to you. We get a lot of that. Or I wish my parents, all these messages will be there throughout the whole series, and you can go back and watch them over again. Now, today we're going to tackle something that all of us have wrestled with at some point along the way. Today, I want to talk about, within the context of faith and religion, the role of rules, the role of rules. Because in every religion, there are these pesky rules. And in every religion, there is a rule maker. And guess what? It never gets to be us, does it? Maybe we should, like, wouldn't it be great just to start your own religion? You go, I'm gonna start my own religion, and I'm gonna make the rules. But in every single religion, we run up against rules. There's like the five pillars of Islam, there's the Ten Commandments, there's the Sermon on the Mount, and every single, you know, and the Sikhism has a long list of rules or things you're supposed to do. Buddhists have principles. I mean, everybody has kind of this list of things. And again, because we don't get to make the rules, we find ourselves kind of buttoned up against them. And then there's this whole thing of like, I grew up as in a Christian home and Christian faith, and, you know, pastor of a Christian church, so I can kind of poke poke fun at Christians a little bit. You know, I won't poke fun at the rest. But in Christianity, it's really weird because we have all these different versions. You know, first of all, you have Catholic and Protestant. And then within Protestant, there's like a million different applications, right? So I grew up Baptist and we had our set of rules. The Presbyterians had their set of rules. The Methodist, we didn't think they had enough rules, honestly. Okay, as the Baptists, you know, because they just had way a little bit too much fun, Catholics, you know, that was a whole kind of different thing. But everybody, there was enough guilt for all of us, right? There was enough shame to go around for all of us. There was enough being judged, you know, where sometimes you did well, sometimes you didn't do so well. But the question I want to ask today is, what's with all the rules? I mean, why, you know, why is that such a part of religion? And it's what we bump up against. And let's be honest, don't raise your hand. It's what we rebel against. It's part of why you left, you know, the faith of your, you know, your foundational faith. It's why you decided not to go back to temple or go back to church, or you kind of got fed up with the mosque or whatever it is you walked away from. Part of it was just the rules that were just so onerous, and it just didn't seem to work with the real world. So what I want to talk about today in a general way is, what's the relationship between rules and religion? And specifically, is there a relationship, or is there sort of a starting point in our understanding between rules and a God who we believe somehow cares about us, created the world, and loves us? So let's begin with this premise, and maybe this is something you haven't thought about before. Rules always assume some kind of relationship. Wherever you have rules, there is some kind of relationship. Whether it's, you know, secular or in a religious sense, wherever there are, you find rules and you find yourself where you're accountable to a set of rules, in any sphere where you are accountable to a set of rules, you are in some kind of relationship. Now, to help us understand this and to get our discussion going, I've made up some categories, okay? I just made these up. If you have better categories, go right ahead. For example, there's like the family model of rules, and then there's the club model. The family model was, you were born into a family, and you were a part of the family, and then your parents started making rules. They didn't make rules to make you a part of the family. You were already part of the family, and they established rules. They established rules when you were a kid, then when you were in middle school, then in high school, and then eventually you outgrew the family and you outgrew the rules, and you're still part of the family, but you don't have to obey the rules. But when you were a kid growing up, you had rules not to become part of the family, but because you were part of the family. And so your parents or your parent set rules for you. Now, the interesting thing about the whole parent rule is this. Parents only set rules for their own kids. Now, we have all met kids from other families that we would like to set rules for, right? If you ever wanted to put your neighbor's kids on restriction, like, as long as we live here, you're not allowed out of your home. Once we move, then you're off restriction, right? You've never called your neighbors and said, hey, I want to talk to your daughter. Have you finished your homework? What are you still doing up? Okay, turn off the television. Why? They're not your kids. So this is really important. In the family sense of the word, rules are for members of the family. The rules don't make you part of the family. The rules are because you are part of the family. And the parental units, father, you know, mother, whoever, or grandparents, they set rules for their own kids or for their own grandkids. Now, the second model is the club model. In this model, you agree to keep a certain number of rules or agree to keep some rules in order to get in or to begin the relationship. So when you join a club, they give you a contract, you read it, and if you agree, you sign. And once you sign, and once you agree to keep these rules, you're in. And if you break the rules, you're what? You're out. Yeah, first row. You guys always have the answers down here. That's awesome. Yeah. Now, this could also be like the employee model, like when you go to work for a company and they say, here's how we do it here, and here's what we expect of you, and here's your job description. And so you may sign some sort of contract, but you agree. And once you agree to the rules, that's how you get in. This works for fraternities and sororities, and the list goes on and on and on, but it's different. In this model, you get the rules after the relationship is established. In this model, you actually get the rules in order to establish the relationship. Now, just for fun, because this gets confusing, I've created this third category. This is called the neighborhood association model. Now, in the neighborhood association model, you don't always know where you stand, okay? You're free to buy the house and get in, and as long as you obey the, you know, the neighborhood covenants, everybody's fine. But then if you kind of get squirrely, or, you know, you didn't pay attention, then you start getting nasty notes in your mailbox. You ever get this? And it's kind of like, if you don't get that above, you know, ground pool out of your front yard, you know, we're going to, you know, put a fence around your yard and take that trampoline while you're with you, you know? And so with the neighborhood association model, you kind kind of in, you're kind of out. If you behave, you're in. They can't actually make you move. They can't throw you out of the neighborhood, but they can treat you in such a way that you wish you lived somewhere else. So these are just kind of the models. Now, the point of all this is wherever there are rules and wherever you're accountable to a set of rules, you are in a relationship of some sort. These two things go together. Now, if you take these kind of crazy ideas and then you transpose it onto religious belief or religious system, you can see why this is so confusing. Because which one is it? Is it you're in with God and no matter what you do, you're in, but you have rules to live by? Or is it, hey, if you behave, you get in and you got to keep behaving or I'm going to kick you out? Or is it, well, you're in because, you know, you're a human being, like all human beings are in, but every once in a while you're going to get a note in your mailbox and I can't actually kick you out. I can just treat you really bad until you change your life and I'm going to guilt you to death and shame you to death. And I will never be fully happy with you as a human being, but I will put up with you for a few years on this planet. Now, the interesting thing is when I throw all those categories out, some of you begin to think theologically and others of you begin to think emotionally, because all of us, as we kind of sort through this, is there a God? Is there a personal God? You know, how does all this work? There's such an emotional component to this, because some of you were taught this, but you feel like this. Some of you were taught this and you've never, ever, ever felt like you were part of a family, even though the people have told you you're part of a family. So which one is it? And how do we know? And regardless if you embrace Christianity or any of the known world religions, at some point along the way, you're going to wrestle at least at the conscience level with how does my behavior line up with God and what does God expect of me and when am I in and when am I out? And how in the heck am I supposed to know? So, to help us wrestle this question to the ground, or at least create a framework for your own struggle with this, I want us to go all the way back to one of the oldest set of laws ever given. It's not the oldest, but it's about the third oldest in terms of human history. And it's the most well documented because it found its way into Jewish literature and Christian literature and Islamic literature, believe it or not. And it's the one that's the most well known, and we call it basically the Ten Commandments. Around 1446 BC, the Ten Commandments shows up on the planet, given to God, supposedly. Christians believe that, and Muslims believe that, and Jews believe that. You got to figure that out for yourself. Supposedly given to Moses by God, the Ten Commandments. Now, the interesting thing about Ten Commandments is nobody knows 10 of them. We only know 2. Okay, so just real quick, all right, just what your favorite, you only know 2, I promise, you might know 3, okay, but most of you know, don't commit adultery, you know, and don't steal, or, you know, you sort of, in your mind, there's sort of, in there, be honest and tell the truth, one's sort of written in there, but other than those 2 or 3, we don't know. The other thing you don't know about the Ten Commandments, but after today you will, is if somebody handed you a Bible and said, are you sure it's in there? You pick up the Bible and go, I'm sure it's in here, where is it? And you're like, it's in here. So I'm going to tell you where to find the Ten Commandments. The next time it comes up, not only will you know more than one, you'll be able to say, I know exactly where that is. So just repeat after me. And if you're watching this at home alone or with a group, just participate or on television. Here we go. Say Exodus 20. One more time. Exodus 20. So where's the Ten Commandments? See, that was probably worth getting up or switching something on or coming to church for today. All right, Exodus chapter 20. Now, before we look at them, real quick, if you weren't here last week or if you were, I want to kind of tie all this together, because last week we talked about Abraham, okay? Abraham's huge in, you know, many of the oldest world religions. Abraham, so I want to kind of catch you up so we can have a little history that connects all these dots. So here's what happened. Abraham was promised by God that he was going to be a nation. One day you're going to be a nation. The problem is Abraham didn't have any children until he was old. And as he was getting older, he kind of panicked. So he said to his wife, Sarah, hey, or maybe actually Sarah said to him, Abraham, look, I can't have children, but my handmaiden can. So, you know, whatever, and see, maybe we can kind of have a kid. So they do, and his name is Ishmael. And then later on, Sarah turns up pregnant. She has a son named Isaac. So as it turns out, Abraham actually ends up with 2 sons. Now, here's something interesting, and you can read this on your own. In Islam, Ishmael is considered the son of blessing. In Judaism and in Christianity, Isaac is considered the son of blessing. So these two, you know, these two world religions go two different directions. But mostly, most of what we know in terms of Ishmael being the son of blessing actually was taught about 600 and something years after Jesus by the prophet Muhammad, who came along and kind of brought all this knowledge together and sort of wove this narrative that connected the Arab nations back to Ishmael, back to Abraham. So that's a little bit of little religious history for you there. Isaac had a son named Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons that eventually became the 12 tribes of Israel. A little history for you. One of these sons was named Joseph. His brothers did not like him because he had a coat of many colors, and so they put him in a pit. He ended up in Egypt, and he ended up becoming the prime minister of Egypt. There was a famine in the land. He sent email to all of his sons and all his brothers and all their families, said, there's plenty of food in Egypt. Come to Egypt. They all go to Egypt. And so all of Abraham's, you know, grandchildren, great-great-great-grandchildren all end up in Egypt, and this family becomes a nation in Egypt, and they're multiplying like rabbits. And the people come to Pharaoh and said, hey, if we don't do something about these Hebrews, there's going to be more Hebrews than Egyptians. So they enslaved them. And so for 400 years, this family becomes a nation, but they are a slave nation. Generation after generation after generation, all they know is slavery. And when they would get together and have Bible stories or religious stories, they would tell stories about Father Abraham. Children, a long, long time ago, there was a man named Abraham, and God promised Abraham that one day his family would be a nation. Yes, you in the back. So we're that nation? Yes. We're slaves. It didn't work out well for us. Oh, don't worry, because God promised Abraham that the whole world would be blessed through us. Yes, you in the back. We're slaves. I know. Quit asking those pesky, you know, Sunday school questions. Okay, I know it doesn't really match up with the real world, you know. So once again, there was this conflict of here's what we're supposed to believe and here's current reality. So for 400 years, there's all these kind of mythical stories about Abraham, and he had a son, and he had a son and a dream and all this stuff about Joseph, but it was so long ago. And none of this stuff's ever going to come true. You're just telling us those stories so we'll have faith and believe and won't give up hope. And then, out of the blue, one day, a man shows up named Moses, and he goes to Pharaoh, and let's just all say it together, and he says, that's right, let my people go, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, no, I'm not going to let your people go. And Moses says, well, watch this. And all of a sudden, nature completely freaks out. I mean, it's like locusts and boils and ticks and frogs and water pollution. It just goes on and on and on. And the next thing you know, Egypt's whole economy is wrecked. And then Moses is like, you know, let my people go. You let my people go. So eventually, if you know the story, Moses leads the nation of Israel away from Egypt. Now, this is just a little interesting fun fact. Did you know the name Moses appears more in the Quran than any other name? That's from my research. You can research it for yourself. That the name Moses shows up in the Quran. So this whole thing about Moses and leading his people, this isn't just a Jewish thing or a Christian thing. This was, you know, this is history. So anyway, Moses leads the people out, and about 3 weeks later, they end up at Mount Sinai. And now Moses goes up to get God's law. Because remember, this is important. All they know is slavery. They have a little civil society, but it kind of happens within the context of Egyptian slavery. They don't know their God. They're just slaves. They think like slaves for generations. They've just been slaves, no freedom. So they go to Mount Sinai, and according to the story, Moses goes up on the mountain, and God gives this nation their first set of laws. And part of it is the Ten Commandments. And you can find those in that's right, Exodus chapter 20. See how smart you are. So now, what I want to read for you, or we're going to read together, is the prelude or the beginning or the introduction to the Ten Commandments. And in these two verses, we get a major, major clue or an insight as to how religion and God and rules and law all fit together. Here's how it begins. And God spoke all these words to Moses, and here's what he says, and to the nation. I am the Lord your God. Really? Yep, I'm the Lord your God. Well, that would make us your people. Yep. Well, how did that happen? When did that happen? I mean, we haven't even done anything. We've been in slavery for 400 years, and you drag us out through all these miracles, and now suddenly you're our God and we're your people. How did that happen? I mean, we haven't even done anything. Like magically, we're just like your people? I mean, and he goes on. Who brought you out of Egypt and out of the land of slavery? That I'm the Lord your God. And this is huge, okay, as we kind of piece all this together. I'm the Lord your God who has done something for you and you have done nothing for me. I'm the Lord your God who sent a deliverer in your darkest time when you had given up hope. When Abraham is a fairy tale, you tell your children so they won't lose hope. When nobody expected it, I sent a deliverer into Egypt and I dragged you out of Egypt, and I am the Lord your God who delivered you out of Egypt. I have done something miraculous and spectacular for you, and you haven't done a thing for me. Well, you're right, because we don't even know what to do. We don't even know what the rules are. We don't even know if we've broken the rules or kept the rules. I mean, we don't even have any rules yet. This is if God said, I know. Before I give you the rules, I just want you to know, you're mine and I'm yours. And let's establish that before we start talking about the rules. A really interesting thing happened in Egypt. After the plagues, and you can read all about that, you know, in the book of Exodus and all these things, it's just amazing what happens. And at the end, when the Egyptian economy is decimated, I mean, Pharaoh is finally like, okay, well, you know, I don't know. Finally, the most interesting thing happens. God, through the prophet Moses, speaks to the Jewish people. And he says, God has one thing he wants you to do. This is no Ten Commandments, no law, nothing. There's something God wants you to do. What is that? And Moses, on behalf of God, would say to the nation while they were still in Egypt, he would say, God wants you to trust him. God's message for you is simply this: trust me. And tonight, before you go to bed, I want you to slaughter a lamb or a sheep, which they did all the time. And I want you to have a meal, which they did all the time. But I want you to take the blood of this lamb, and I want you to put it over your door and down the sides of your door. Why would we do that? God says, trust me. But what difference is it? God says, but that's not going to make any difference. God says, trust me. And so that night, the majority of the Jewish people had a special meal, and they slaughtered a sheep, and they took the blood of that sheep and they put it over their doors and they put it down the sides of their doors. And then they packed everything they had because they were told the next day they would be leaving. Really? We've been here for 400 years and we're leaving tomorrow? Trust me, God would say. And that night, the angel of death went into all the land of Egypt, and it passed over every household where the blood was over the door. And the next morning, Pharaoh said, go and take everything you own and take anything we own. Just go. And from that moment on, the Jewish people would celebrate the festival of Passover, to remember not the Ten Commandments, not the law of God, to remember this night when God whispered to the nation, I just want you to trust me. And in trusting me, you will find your deliverance from slavery in Egypt. And 3 weeks later, they're gathered at the foot of Mount Sinai. And God says, okay, now I'm going to give you some law, but let's make sure we don't forget the most important thing. I am the Lord your God. You are my people. I'm the one who delivered you from slavery. Now there's some things I want you to do as we learn to live together and as I help you live together. And then he gave them their first commandment. Now this is amazing. So here's the first commandment, and it's not a thou shalt not. The very first commandment in the Ten Commandments is this. First commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. To which collectively the whole nation went, duh. Really? That's it? Okay, let me get this straight. You deliver us from slavery. Our children have a future. Our grandchildren have a future. We're going to have our own land. We have our own God. We have our own leader. And all you want us to do is make sure we have no other gods before you. You can put a check in that box. Of course we wouldn't have any other God before you. Who can compete with the God who wrecked the economy of Egypt, embarrassed Pharaoh, and delivered us from slavery? You are our God. What do you have after that? Now here's the point of all that. Here's something to think about. The Ten Commandments were a confirmation, not a condition, of their relationship with God. The Ten Commandments were confirmed. It wasn't a condition. It's like, okay, I'm going to give you 10 things, and if you do these things, you can be my people. If you mess up 5 out of the 10, then, you know, we'll see. But if you get to 8, okay, I'm going to get me some more people. This is so important. The Ten Commandments, the oldest law, this is 1,500 years before Jesus. This is 2,100 years before the prophet Muhammad, as far back as we can go and connect law to God. And it didn't have to be this way. It could have been completely conditional. But in the very beginning, as far back as we can go, God made it clear to the nation of Israel, you are my people, even though you haven't done a thing to deserve it. And now that we've established the relationship, I want to teach you how to live together and how to live under my authority. So let's begin with the basic. Just don't have any other gods than me. And what else do I need to do to demonstrate the fact that you can trust me? Now, here's something interesting. If you've ever tried to read the Old Testament, it's interesting because Genesis is kind of fun. Exodus, you know, is fun. In fact, in Exodus, we find the Ten Commandments in chapter 20, right? And then you get to Leviticus and it's like, what? And Deuteronomy, you know, Numbers and Deuteronomy. It's like, didn't you just say that? And then you get to the prophets eventually. And if you've ever tried to read the prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and all these, it's like the same thing over and over and over and over. And it's like, what's with these ranting, raving, lunatic men that are just mad? They're just mad all the time. Then suddenly they say something grand and glorious and, you know, worship leaders pull songs, you know, lines out of some of these prophets. And it goes back into the, and I'm going to, you know, do this, I'm going to do that. And if you don't. And let me tell you what that is. The prophets are evidence of the fact that God wasn't going to give up on his people, even when they disobeyed the laws. The prophets are God being a good parent. The prophets are all about God saying, okay, 1, 2, 3, you're in timeout. 1, and God would count to 3 over and over and put nation in timeout. Count to 1, 2, 3, and then put the nation of Israel in timeout. One time he said, okay, I'm gonna put you in timeout for 70 years. You sit in the corner over there in Babylon for 70 years, and then when that whole generation's died out, I'm gonna bring you back. But I'm not giving up on you. Not because of what you've done, but because you are my people and I chose you to be my people before I ever gave you the first thou or thou shalt not. And the history of Israel is a history of God saying it's not the club model. It's the parent model. It's the family model. So essentially, we can say this. With God, relationship precedes rule. God opts for the family model over the club model. That's how he treated the nation of Israel. The question is that how he treats you? Is that how he treats me? And what we're gonna see, and if you take the Christian faith seriously, and again, scrape away and put away all the things maybe you thought about in childhood and start all over, you'll eventually come to this conclusion. The bottom line is, in terms of the role of rules, that the rules are confirmation, not a condition of a relationship with God. That the rules really are a confirmation of, not a condition of, a relationship with God. That God is like a parent. He only gives rules to people who are kids who are already in relationship with him. Now, if that's true, regardless of where you land in terms of whatever religious system you land in, if that's true, that's staggering. If God's relationship with the nation of Israel is a model, that you can rebel and be disobedient and go left, too far left and too far right and forget things and do your own thing. And God keeps coming back over and over and over and disciplining and disciplining and disciplining. Disciplining not to pay you back, but to bring you back like a good parent. That's staggering. That says something about the expansive and amazing and the wealth of God's love and God's mercy and God's kindness. But. What if Abraham and what if the nation of Israel were just kind of aberrations? In other words, what if God plays favorites? What if God just liked Abraham? Abraham, I'll tell you what, you believe me once, you're in forever. Israel, I'm bored, I need something to do, I'm just gonna pick some people. I pick you, Israel, and I'm gonna let you be my people. You're my people even before I give any Ten Commandments. But these Americans, I don't know. Canadians, I don't know. Europeans, no. What if God plays favorites? What if it's true of Abraham? What if it was true of the nation of Israel? But what if for the rest of us, it's just, hey, you guys do the best you can, and I'll let you know how it works out. You guys just be good. And then one day I'll tell you if you are good enough. The Ten Commandments, yeah, that's the standard. You're going to have to work your way in. And you'll never really know if you're in, because I'm not going to make the standard clear enough for you to know whether or not you're in. You will never know if I grade on a curb. You're not going to know. I'm not going to tell you if I grade on the curve. You'll just have to spend your whole life, be the best that you can, and then in the judgment, you'll find out where you stood with me. What if God played favorites? What if Abraham and the nation of Israel were just his favorites? The rest of us, good luck. Be good. And then I'll tell you if you were good enough. Now, here's the amazing thing. As you consider all this, as you consider your starting point for faith, when God made the promise to Abraham that we looked at last week, when God initiated his relationship with Israel that we've looked at this week, one thing is absolutely for certain, if you read the narrative yourself, that this was not about Abraham, and it wasn't even about the nation of Israel. It was about all mankind. And here's how we know that. Remember this promise to Abraham from last week? God said, all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. All the nations, not just the nation that you will become, or not just the nations that you will become. All nations on the earth will be blessed through you. And then later, the prophet Isaiah would say to the nation of Israel, listen to this, I will also make you, the nation of Israel, a light to the rest of us, to the Gentiles. In other words, Jewish nation, Israel, it's not just about you. You're gonna be like a signpost. You're gonna be like a sign. You're gonna be like a candle in the evening. You're gonna be like a bright shining light in the darkness. You're gonna be a light to the rest of the world, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. Israel, as much as I love you, as much as I've chosen you, it's bigger than you. Abraham, as much as I love you, as much as I've chosen you, as much as I've given you an out, as patient as I've been with you, it's bigger than you. This is about the whole world. And so, we shouldn't be completely surprised when about 1,500 years after the giving of the law to the nation of Israel, 1,500 years later, Jesus walks onto the planet. And what does he do? Before he demands anything, before he requires anything, he turns nature upside down, and he heals, and he stops storms, and he speaks to wind. And he does things that no one can imagine that any human being could do. And those who were closest to him were often terrified at his power. And then he said, trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Because the promise that God fulfilled to Abraham and the promise that God fulfilled through Israel is a promise for all men and women. And as it began through faith with Abraham, as it continued through faith with the nation of Israel, should we be surprised that such a message for the world would be extended through the prophet, the Lord Jesus Christ? And so John, who knew Jesus best, John, who again, when Jesus was dying, he said, John, you take care of my mom. That's John. Here's what John said, looking back on his time with Jesus. He said this. He said, yet to all who did receive him, to those who behaved, believed. Now what? Now ready? Then we're done. To those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become club members, neighborhood association members, children of God. Jesus said, as God began a nation through Abraham, as God adopted the nation of Israel as his own, so that invitation to become a child of the living God has been extended to all of humanity, which means it's the family model, which means this is so important, anything I require of you is evidence of my love for you. Anything I ask you to do is evidence of the fact that we have a pre-established relationship. you can trust me. Because all along it has been about you. And that's where we're going to pick it up next week. Now, I got a question for you, okay? I'm going to give you a question. Every one of these messages, we have a question. Here's what I want you to talk about in starting point groups. Here's what I want you to talk about in your community groups, your small groups, on the way home, at lunch today, at dinner tonight, whatever it is. Here's a question I would love for you to answer out loud with a group of people. Here it is. Growing up, did you feel like, this is important, I don't want this to be a theological discussion, okay? Some of you, you know the right answer. This isn't about that. Growing up, did you feel like religion was based on the family model, the club model, or the neighborhood association model? When you think about how you were raised and what you were taught and how you felt in your relationship with God, when you'd lay in bed at night and it was all dark and you were saying your prayers or you said your prayers or you would go to church or you'd listen to your teacher, your Sunday school teacher, or the messages, wherever you, whatever your religious education was about, maybe it was in an elementary school or a middle school or a high school and you were part of some religious system, whatever it was. Did you feel like that God had adopted a family model wherein because you're in, I've given you something to do, but I love you and you can never be thrown out, you're part of my family? Or did it feel more like, hey, if you keep your end of the deal, I'll keep my end of the deal? Or did it feel like you just never knew that maybe God wasn't gonna throw you out, but he didn't like you very much? I want you to wrestle that question to the ground. I want you to talk about that with some other people, because next week we're gonna come back and we're gonna pick it up right there. Any questions? No? Good. Let me pray for you. Father, thank you so very much for preserving these ancient texts and these ancient documents through the ages, thousands of years. And here we are with this. We own them. We carry them around. Father, please, 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 in your grace and mercy, open our eyes to whatever it is you want us to see, that regardless of how we felt growing up, regardless of what we believed, We want to get this right, and we want to worship you as you are, not how we imagine you to be. And Father, for those listening or watching who years ago they gave up on ever knowing, they just decided we can't know, there's no point in ever knowing, would you in your grace and mercy just give just a little bit of light, allow it to shine through and spark a sense of hope in us that you can be known, and then give us the courage to take whatever step we think is necessary. And we pray all of these things, Father, in the matchless name of Jesus. Amen. Hey, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next week for part 5 of Starting Point, the series. Have a great rest of your weekend.